I want to welcome you today to our next briefing on Medicaid and CHIP coverage. We're looking at today and looking for tomorrow. For many of you, this may seem like a new endeavor, but this is actually our 10th time to take an assessment of what the state levels for eligibility for Medicaid and CHIP are, and to look at how the enrollment procedures are structured at the state level and what that means for participation and availability of coverage, especially for low-income children, but also for their parents. I'm Diane Rowland with the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured and the Kaiser Family Foundation, and we're pleased to welcome you this morning to our Barbara Jordan Conference Center for what I hope will be both an enlightening and entertaining discussion of some of the challenges and issues that the states are facing as they try and provide coverage for their lowest income residents. We are going to be presenting the findings today from Holding Steady, Looking Ahead, annual findings of the 50-state survey of Medicaid and CHIP eligibility and enrollment. And we wanted to start with just a few charts to remind you of the issues that we are facing and why these coverage imperatives have become so important at the state level and are such a major feature of healthcare reform. See which one brings it up. And clearly, as we look ahead, we know that we are facing a growing uninsured population, which is the momentum for being able to try and provide better and broader coverage. And one of the building blocks of that coverage will obviously be both the Medicaid and the CHIP programs. But as this slide so graphically shows you, we've had an increase since 2004 of over 7 million more Americans without health insurance coverage during the year. And what we see in that progress, though, is that the growing problem has been largely among the adult population. We have made some progress in some years of reducing the number of children without coverage and have held steady pretty much for coverage for children. But in addition to that, we really need to think about what the challenges that the coverage that Medicaid and CHIP provide offer for coverage of the low-income population. And what we see here is that among the uninsured population, the most substantial share, 60%, are adults without dependent children. In most states, those individuals are ineligible for the Medicaid program because of the previous bar until health reform for coverage of that population under Medicaid without a waiver. 17% of our uninsured are children, a target of trying to improve broader coverage right now as well as under health care reform. And another quarter are the parents of those children, adults with children under age 18. And as we look across the country, we know that if you are in one state and see one state Medicaid program, you've seen one state Medicaid or CHIP program. And here we also see that you see very wide differences in the percent of the population without insurance coverage, with large numbers of people without coverage throughout the South and much of the West, and higher levels of coverage among the more previously industrialized Northeast as well as some of the Midwest. And clearly differences occur between rural and urban areas. It's really reflective of whether the economy provides for a lot of agricultural base, for a lot of small businesses. But we see that the challenge different states will face will be very different in terms of getting their population covered. But we especially are also going to see, as this report will reveal, that some of the differences in the current eligibility levels today for coverage for the lowest income population under Medicaid and under CHIP. And when we look at the challenges, we do see that among children, the Medicaid program and the CHIP program together provide coverage for over 60% of low-income children, but parents and adults without children lag far behind. Adults without children only covered if they qualify either through a waiver or on the basis of disability. So these are some of the forces that we need to look at, some of the issues about how well this population is being served today and where some of the increases in eligibility will have to occur under health care reform. I referenced at the beginning that this was our 10th year, and I should really note that this has always in our jargon been called the Kaiser Report with Donna Cohen Ross in the days when she was at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. And so this is the first year that we've shifted to have a new partner in Georgetown with us in Tricia Brooks and Marcia Haberlein and Jocelyn Geyer. And I'm pleased that they've picked up the responsibilities here for continuing this important survey that we do in collaboration with our partners. And I'd also like to recognize and thank Samantha Artiga and Jessica Stevens of the Kaiser staff who have helped to put this together and who, without whom we would never have gotten all those tables out so that you can now look at every state-by-state issue, which will be also featured on our State Facts website. So without further ado, I'm going to start our discussion by asking both Tricia Brooks of the Center for Children and Families at Georgetown and Samantha Artiga, Principal Policy Analyst with our Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured, to present some of the findings to you. And then we're going to turn to three very notable individuals to provide some perspectives. Cindy Mann, known to all of us as the Deputy Administrator and Director of the Center for Medicaid CHIP and Survey and Certification at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Joan Henneberry, the Executive Director of the Colorado Department of Healthcare Policy and Financing, and Mary Wachtel, the Director of Health Policy for Voices of Ohio's Children, to just provide some perspectives on the findings that we'll present today. Full bios, as well as all of the graphics being used in the PowerPoint presentations, are in your packet. So without further ado, let me turn it over to Tricia to start off our findings. Thank you.
Thanks, Diane. And I want to start with saying that at the Georgetown Center for Children and Families, we were delighted to be asked to be involved in this work. As a former CHIP director, I really know what an invaluable resource this report has been to state officials, to policymakers, to all of us policy wonks in the room, and advocates alike. So it is truly our delight to be part of the partnership. And Diane recognized the members of the project team, but I want to say that I can't imagine working with a better team, one that's more committed to getting it right. And when you look at the nitty-gritty details in this report, there's a lot to try to get right. So thanks to Samantha and Jessica and Martha and Jocelyn for all their great work on not only the report, but the surveys and the collection and crunching of the data that behind that. Ditto, Diane's comments of recognizing Donna and her colleagues at the Center for building a strong foundation. And last but not least, we would be remiss if we did not express our deep appreciation to the state officials who shared their time and their knowledge, who gave us the foundation for this report. Truly, without their participation and probably more their patience, this project would not be possible. So very quickly about the survey, as Diane mentioned, it's the 10th in the series. It's based on extensive telephone interviews with state officials. It covers eligibility rules, enrollment and renewal procedures, and cost-sharing practices in both Medicaid and CHIP as they relate to children, pregnant women, and parents. This year, we included more questions about coverage for adults without dependent children, and we probed a bit more into systems and technology. The survey provides a snapshot of policies in place as of January 1, 2011, and it also highlights the changes made during 2010. Let's start by looking at the key factors that impacted state policy over the past year. In 2010, the economic downturn continued, and families across America continued to face economic uncertainty due to persistently high levels of unemployment. The corresponding loss of access to employer-sponsored insurance created an increased need for public coverage. This put added pressure on state budgets that were already stressed by the bad economy and decreased state revenues. However, the increased federal support for Medicaid through the Recovery Act bolstered the ability of states to meet this increased need for health care. This extra financial help was accompanied by a maintenance of effort provision that states hold steady in their Medicaid eligibility levels as well as their enrollment and renewal procedures. 2010 also saw the enactment of the Affordable Care Act, which, among many other important provisions, establishes a new eligibility floor for Medicaid at 133% of poverty for all Americans in 2014. Not only does this end the historic exclusion of childless, non-disabled adults in Medicaid, but the ACA gives states the flexibility to expand Medicaid early. The ACA also extended the important maintenance of effort protections to children covered in CHIP. Lastly, the options provided through reauthorization of the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIPRA, also helped shape state activity in 2010, as it had in 2009. As a result of this policy and fiscal environment, Medicaid and CHIP were strikingly stable in 2010, with all but two states maintaining coverage for children and adults. States provided much-needed coverage and peace of mind to families while they looked for jobs and struggled to pay the bills. Without Medicaid and CHIP, the uninsured rate, which reached a record 50 million, most certainly would have been higher. Some states actually went beyond maintaining coverage to make targeted expansions and program improvements. As we've seen in past surveys, most of these changes, which affect eligibility and efforts to achieve administrative efficiencies by removing red tape, were focused on children. One notable trend continues. Access to coverage does not come close to match access to coverage for parents does not come close to matching that of their children, and coverage for non-disabled adults lags even further behind. States are progressing in their use of technology to reduce paperwork and streamline procedures, but most states have a substantial amount of work to bring their systems capability in line with the consumer-friendly paperless systems that are envisioned by the Affordable Care Act. So let's take a closer look at the top-line survey findings. A total of 13 states expanded eligibility by either raising income limits, by using CHIPRA to cover lawfully residing immigrant children and pregnant women, or by taking up the ACA option to expand adult coverage through Medicaid early. 14 states also made improvements to their enrollment and renewal procedures. These actions were varied and range from dropping the asset test or face-to-face interview requirement to adopting presumptive eligibility, 12 months continuous coverage, or express lane eligibility. I'll cover some of these data as they relate to children and then turn it over to Samantha to talk about adult coverage and wrap up with a look ahead. In 2010, three states, Kansas, Colorado, and Oregon, raised income eligibility in their CHIP programs. Oklahoma also expanded coverage to some children through its premium assistance program. As a result of these expansions, half of the states, including D.C., now cover children at 250% of poverty or higher. Only four states have income limits below 200%. Arizona was the sole state moving backward for children by putting a freeze on enrollment in its CHIP program before the CHIP maintenance of effort provision went into effect. As a result of the continued improvements in enrollment and renewal procedures, nearly all states have now eliminated face-to-face interview requirements for children at both application and renewal, and no longer look at assets when determining eligibility for these programs. Almost all states allow the maximum 12 months before a child's eligibility must be renewed, but less than half of the states assure a full 12 months of continuous coverage. And while we've seen progress in the use of technology to verify income through other data sources, such as wage databases or tax agencies, only 12 states use this capability to eliminate paperwork for new applicants and 18 for those who are renewing coverage. 13 states now use presumptive eligibility in both programs to allow qualified entities such as hospitals or community health centers to screen eligibility and temporarily enroll children so they can get needed services while their parents complete the regular application process. Since its enactment in February of 2009, we're getting really close to celebrating the second anniversary. CHIPRA has helped shape state activity. Now, without a question, the most prevalent improvement made in 2010 was adoption of what has proven to be a highly efficient and accurate way to verify citizenship through an electronic data match with the Social Security Administration. This option proved so popular that we felt it overshadowed the other activity in states, and we chose not to include it in the count of states that made overall improvements. 29 states have successfully implemented the SSA match after it went live on January 1st of 2010, and they have reported significant gains in administrative efficiency, not to mention reduced paperwork burden on families. And 15 more states indicate they plan to adopt this option in 2011. Another popular CHIP provision removed the 5-year waiting period before states could secure federal match to cover lawfully residing immigrant children and pregnant women. A total of 21 states have lifted the 5-year bar for children and 17 for pregnant women. 6 states are early adopters of the new Express Lane eligibility option, which allows states to use the findings of other programs such as SNAP or food stamps to enroll children in Medicaid and CHIP. Overall, these continuing gains, even in the face of tough economic times, illustrate our country's, the president's, and governor's commitment to children's coverage, a commitment that has resulted in a record 90% coverage for children. That's pretty phenomenal in the best of times, not to mention in these tough economic times. Now, unfortunately, the picture isn't quite so rosy for adults, but there are some positive exceptions, and I'll let Samantha share those with you.
Thanks so much, Tricia. As I think Tricia's the information Tricia presented made very clear, states really have achieved some significant progress in covering low-income children, and that's really evident on this figure here. You see the median eligibility threshold in Medicaid and CHIP for children now reaches above 240% of the federal poverty level, yet it's also really clear how far behind coverage lags for their parents and for other non-disabled low-income adults. You'll see that for parents, the median eligibility level remains well below the federal poverty level. And as was mentioned earlier, other low-income non-disabled adults generally remain ineligible for Medicaid, reflecting the fact that prior to the passage of health reform, states could not cover these adults through Medicaid unless they obtained a waiver to provide that coverage. So looking nationwide, with the addition of an expansion in eligibility for parents in Colorado during 2010, you'll see that 18 states, including the District of Columbia, now provide coverage, Medicaid coverage to parents up to at least the federal poverty level. However, in 33 states, parent eligibility is still restricted to below the poverty level, with 16 states limiting eligibility to below half of poverty, which equates to about $9,000 per year for a family of 3. Turning to look at coverage for other non-disabled low-income adults, during 2010, the District of Columbia and Connecticut moved to take up the new option provided in health reform to move early to cover these adults and moved some adults they had previously been covering with fully state or local funds to Medicaid. Minnesota has also since moved to take up that option, but that movement took place after our survey period, and therefore that change is not reflected in our survey findings. Also in 2010, California obtained a waiver to continue and expand some existing county coverage initiatives serving low-income adults. However, even with these advancements in 2010, what you see here is that currently only 7 states, including D.C., provide Medicaid or Medicaid equivalent benefits to low-income adults without dependent children. Additional states do provide more limited coverage or premium assistance to some of these adults, but generally, these adults remain ineligible for assistance in most cases, regardless of how low their income. Beyond coverage, what this figure shows you is that simplifications and enrollment procedures also lag behind for parents relative to their children. Certainly, a number of gains have been made in recent years, but as you see here, while all states have eliminated the asset test for children, nearly half still require that for parents, and more states continue to require face-to-face interview requirements for parents as well. Overall, what the data, I think, show is that although progress has been made, there's certainly still room for improvement in simplifying procedures for parents and certainly room to better align the policies between children and parents, which will become even more important under health reform. Then turning a bit to look at states' use of technology, which Tricia commented on a bit in her remarks, as states have been moving forward with simplifications in their procedures, they increasingly are turning to technology both to reduce burdens on families as well as to achieve program efficiencies. As she noted, for example, more than half the states took up the new option to use an electronic data match to verify citizenship with the Social Security Administration, and a small but increasing number of states are also turning to use electronic data match to verify other aspects of eligibility. However, states still have a really long road ahead to develop the integrated, web-based, technology-driven enrollment systems that are envisioned and required under reform. And as you see here, while 29 states offer an application that can be submitted electronically with an electronic signature, in most cases, families still are required to submit paper documentation either through mail or fax. And there are some states that still are relying on almost entirely paper-based systems. So given that a number of states are going to need to make large-scale improvements in their systems to create what is envisioned under reform, it's really important for them to begin taking action now to be prepared by 2014. And there's been some recent federal activity along this front to help support state efforts, including a proposed rule to provide a 90% federal match rate for systems development, some new grant funding opportunities, as well as new guidance released to IT systems. And then finally, to wrap up with just some key thoughts to think about moving forward, I think in the immediate term, it's clear that states are facing a really difficult budget situation. State revenues remain depressed. The enhanced federal matching funds provided through ARRA will expire in June, and states are continuing to experience enrollment pressures due to continued increased need for coverage, which will continue until the economy more fully recovers. Keeping Medicaid and CHIP coverage stable is going to be very important for continuing to fulfill families' need for coverage and preventing increased growth in the uninsured looking forward, and also for providing a base for successful implementation of health reform in the coming years. And as states look to implement health reform, they face both challenges and opportunities. They face the challenge of preparing to implement the expansion and upgrading their eligibility and enrollment systems amidst budget pressures, which obviously limit their resources and administrative capacity. However, at the same time, health reform also provides states new opportunities and new options to really vastly streamline their eligibility and enrollment procedures, creating new efficiencies in the program, and to really transform their programs through the use of technology in greater ways. And health reform clearly also provides a really significant potential opportunity for states to reduce the uninsured rate through the expansion in Medicaid coverage, which will eliminate that longstanding gap in coverage for low-income childless adults and provide millions of these currently uninsured adults a new coverage option. So as we will plan in the next year to continue to track state efforts on these fronts and anticipate that we'll continue to see action along these fronts in 2011. And with that, I'll close and turn it back over to Diane.
Thank you, Trish and Samantha. And now we'll turn to Cindy to kick off our discussion.
Thank you, Diane. And thank you, Tricia and Samantha. These are enormously helpful findings for us in terms of understanding where we are now and the road ahead. And I think, as both Tricia and Samantha have said, they're really heartening findings given the very difficult fiscal times that we find ourselves in. Overall, coverage has been maintained and even strengthened thanks to the support of successive pieces of federal legislation, CHIPRA, the Recovery Act, the Affordable Care Act, and, of course, the very strong and concerted efforts on the part of states. So as a result, in these difficult times, Medicaid has lived up to really one of its most fundamental features, which is that it is a countercyclical insurer. Unlike other types of insurance, Medicaid is designed and intended to expand its reach in difficult times when there are more people who qualify for its coverage and need coverage through Medicaid because of either loss of income or loss of employer-based coverage or both. So we're very heartened by the actions taken by states to move forward. And we think that many of the options provided in CHIPRA and in the Recovery Act and the Affordable Care Act have really provided some useful tools. So the new options, just to review some of where we've seen the federal legislation actually translate into real improvements for people. As noted, Connecticut and the District of Columbia have taken advantage of the new early option to cover childless adults that were created in the Affordable Care Act. And we have actually now, since the study was released, a second waiver. Samantha mentioned that California has a waiver to expand coverage for childless adults through its county-based initiative. Washington State has been granted a waiver after the date of this survey to help keep its basic health program going forward, which covers childless adults and other parents. 27 states have picked up the Social Security Administration option. 6 states have Express Lane. Also, both of these are CHIPRA options. 27 states have dropped the 5-year ban for children. 7 states have done so for pregnant women in terms of coverage of lawfully present children and immigrants. And we note also that not only do these provisions advance coverage, either stabilize coverage or advance coverage, but they have also served the purpose of helping states fiscally. In some states, the new coverage option has helped states bring federal dollars to state-funded programs where states have been struggling to provide the coverage with their own dollars, obviously an increasingly difficult thing to do in these fiscal times. And in some states, the new options like the Social Security match and the Express Lane eligibility can reduce administrative burdens for states, making it easier for states to process applications and renewals and to recognizing that there's a great deal of cutbacks in terms of state resources on the administration side. So I wanted to just note a few other initiatives that we've been working on to help coverage move forward. Last week, we were very excited to announce 15 states had qualified for what's called performance bonuses. Those are bonuses, again, provided in the CHIPRA legislation that recognize when states are particularly successful in enrolling the lowest income kids eligible for Medicaid. Those 15 states deserved their bonuses and put out their own state dollars to cover those children, and the bonuses are there to help them shoulder some of those costs. There's over $200 million in bonuses that we provided to states through this initiative, a great deal more than what was available to states in 2009. Over the last year, we've also provided 68 outreach grants to 68 grantees in 42 states and 41 tribal organizations in 19 states. These are, again, SHPRA grants to provide outreach and enrollment assistance in the community. Sometimes these are state grantees. Often they are community-based organization, and most often they are groups and states working together in coalition to really move coverage forward. Also, as noted, the activity around all of this simplification and improving coverage as we move forward really helps us lay the groundwork for implementation to 2014. The performance bonus grants, for example, not only are awarded to states because they have been successful in enrolling more children, but also because they have adopted certain program features in their Medicaid and CHIP programs, which simplify the enrollment and the renewal process that in turn produces greater enrollment, but also produces the kind of system that I think we have all come to realize is what people expect, people want, and people need if they're really going to be able to access the coverage that they need and that they're eligible for. We believe strongly in this administration about the importance of each state having a simple, data-driven, consumer-friendly enrollment experiences, and we're putting our energy, our policy, and some of our money towards that goal. As was mentioned, we issued a notice of public rulemaking in November that we're proposing to raise the federal match rate to 90% for states' improvements in their eligibility systems, as they're all needing to do as we move to 2014. It is not business as usual. We are collaborating with states to make those systems very consumer-friendly, very data-driven, very nimble, and able to serve the needs of the population as well as states. And we think these are the kinds of attributes, better financial support, better technology, more nimble and more effective systems that really what the public wants and ought to have, and that states are really very eager to provide as we move towards 2014. The rule isn't yet final, but we hope that the final rule, whatever it says, and the related support that we're able to give, along with our colleagues at the Office of Consumer Information and Insurance Oversight, OSIO, as it's fondly known, will really provide for a very positive, accurate, and timely enrollment experience for everybody. And we will no longer have the phenomenon of people being eligible for public coverage but yet not enrolled. So I just want to acknowledge the great benefit that this survey has provided over the years. And continues to provide, it really offers all of us, including those of us in the administration, a benchmark for and a roadmap for thinking about the tasks ahead. So thank you.
Thank you, Cindy. Joan will now provide a little state perspective.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me here. We started our health policy and health insurance reforms in Colorado in 2007, and that was, of course, when the economy was better, and Colorado's economy is still much better than many of our colleagues in other states. But we had very aggressive and pretty well-financed outreach efforts. We launched an initiative to enroll all of our children in medical homes. We were rebuilding our medical management, care management programs, increased reimbursement for providers. But by the middle of 2008, you know, all of that was turning around, and we knew that the only way we were going to be able to expand eligibility in our public programs, and at that time we were at federally mandated levels in Medicaid, a little bit higher on the income scale for CHIP kids, up to 205% of poverty, but we knew that there was no way we would be able to go any further without an entirely new revenue source other than state general fund revenues. So we worked for a year with the hospitals and the hospital association to develop a bill that would allow us to assess a provider fee on hospital beds and draw down federal match. And then what's a little bit different with our hospital provider fee than what most states have done in the past, with I believe the exception of maybe Wisconsin, the hospitals agreed that the revenue from those fees and the federal match could also be used to expand eligibility in our public programs. So yes, we do use that money to pay the hospitals closer to what it actually costs them to serve a Medicaid client, but the second priority for those dollars was to use that money to expand eligibility in our public programs, which we have done now. It took us an entire year to work the legislation. Then it took a second year to do all of the planning and systems work and benefit design and working with CMS. But we did get our plan approved and began enrolling people in May of 2010. So we expanded eligibility, as you saw in the chart, from 60% of poverty for parents to 100%, and for children and pregnant women from 205 to 250. Since May, we've enrolled, I think now, about 30,000 individuals into Medicaid and CHIP, and those are mostly the parents, a fairly small number of kids, actually, because we'd enrolled so many kids already. But it was very clear that the there was huge pent-up demand and unmet need among the parents of our low-income children. And then the next two phases of the use of those dollars this year in 2011, we will roll out the third phase, which is expanding eligibility for a disabled buy-in program up to 450% of poverty. And then in 2012, we will create a new program and offer Medicaid to adults without dependent children up to 100% of poverty. So we expect to be on track for that. The main thing that would hold us back would be systems problems or political wind shifts, which I'll talk about in a second. But we expect to go forward with that, which will give us a very solid base on which to build toward 2014. If we can get all of our populations and good enrollment up to 100% of poverty by the end of 2012, mid-2013, we feel we're very well prepared for 2014. We had no idea at the time when we began this planning, of course, and we had a start date of May 2010 in mind from the beginning of when this bill was developed and the bill was passed. We had no idea that literally our go-live date was going to be within 72 hours of when we thought the president was going to sign the health reform bill. And that was very, very important. If you know anything about the maintenance of effort issues and the startup date issues and what happens to you in 2014 if you started before or after the signature. And we really were in the governor's office on a Monday morning deciding whether we go or no go based on whether the president was going to sign the bill. And it turned out well for us, and it will certainly work to Colorado's advantage in the long run. They invite state people to sometimes sound a little negative, or I would like to say bring some reality to the discussion. Many of you in this room know me and know that I lived and worked in this city for 7 years, and it was a great experience. But sometimes you do need to get outside and get a little dose of reality. So the political winds right now are very, very difficult, even for a state like Colorado that, we're touted as being what I call the next generation states. We're not the pioneer states, one of the pioneer states that worked on health reform. We did all of this work with great support from our governor. We couldn't have done it. We could not have done what we did without the governor. And with almost bipartisan support in the legislature, and lots of support from the healthcare community, fabulous, fabulous support from the hospitals, from the medical society, advocacy groups, you name it. But the fact is the budget is still pretty rotten. I mean, and again, we're not nearly as bad off as many states. We think we've done all the cuts we have to make. We've already done three round of cuts in the 10-11 budget, the current fiscal year we're in. We think we're done, but there's at least one more round of revenue forecasting that will happen. We've submitted a budget for the 11-12 year that starts July 1, and that we know that is probably $1 billion short for the entire state. And our state general fund, I think, is, I don't know, $15 billion maybe. So the budget cuts aren't finished. We know 11-12 is still going to be a bad year. We hope 12-13 will stabilize a little bit more. And we're seeing a little bit of a slow in the growth of enrollment in our public programs, but there's still thousands of people enrolling every single month, thousands every month. And we're working hard to make that happen. I mean, we very much believe that if the policy allows for people to receive a benefit, we want them in the door. That's the whole point. If we're not going to go work really hard to get people the benefits that the policymakers have said they should have, then there's no point in doing that. But we are worried about that quite a bit. We have, like every state, we have a whole slew of new elected legislators who start their day tomorrow, start their session, and someone has already dropped a bill to repeal our hospital provider fee. Now, it's not going to pass. It may get out of committee, but there's still enough people who support it, and there's still enough political wrangling that it won't pass. But it's just an indication of the not just the lack of support for the things that we all believe in, but a lack of knowledge with all of the new players, both on the executive side and the legislative side, people who just genuinely do not understand that by having a hospital provider fee and expanding coverage to, you know, 100,000 more people in Colorado without the use of general fund, what a gift that is to be able to do that. And to repeal it really does nothing to save general fund money. It just sends a political message about whether you believe in public insurance or not. We're experiencing a lot of what I call federal fallout in Colorado, and I think many states are. The rhetoric that goes on in this town sort of trickles down and gets out to states, and you hear the same sort of thing. A number of key legislators in our state who oppose what we're doing, not because they don't think we should be helping low-income families. They don't believe we should be doing anything to contribute to the federal deficit. So even when I say things like, well, we're expanding coverage without general fund, they say, well, I don't care because you're still drawing down federal match and that's contributing to the federal deficit. So you're getting those kinds of arguments. And at the same time, we have somebody who's dropped a bill who wants us to do a single-payer plan and get a mega waiver from the federal government and just take all of your money and do whatever we're going to do with it. So it's just a very interesting environment out there in the states, and I don't think we're unique in that sense. And the last thing I'll say, more germane to this conversation, that we are one of the states that has county-based eligibility and enrollment. So we only have 5.5 million people, and we have 64 counties. So 64 administrative structures, 64 counties with hundreds of workers shuffling paper, and frankly, the counties are very resistant to some of the changes that we have been trying to make and that are reflected in this report, electronic exchange of data, eliminating all the paper, online self-service kinds of things. Those are jobs. Those are jobs to counties. And no matter what we say about how important it is to families and making life easier for the families, county commissioners cannot afford to be running for re-election when they've laid off county workers because we're doing a better job. So that's just the political and the reality of some of the dynamics and the tensions that can occur. And you can get beyond those. You have to build lots of support and coalitions and get enough people on your side to move forward with those things, but it's not always as easy as one would like.
Thank you, Joan. And we don't just have you come for negative views. We have you come for a dose of where the rubber meets the road. Thanks.
I'm also glad to be here. It's fun to be with friends and a lot of folks in the audience, including on the panel, Cindy and Tricia, who have worked very closely with Ohio over the last several years and helped get us to where we are. And I'm one of those persons who looks forward to this report every year, pores over its findings, and we use it nonstop to inform our work and our strategy and educate the work in Ohio. So thank you for, once again, a great report and giving me the opportunity to be here. My organization, Voices for Ohio's Children, works to improve public policy for the lives of Ohio's children and families. We're part of Voices for America's Children, the national network of child advocacy organizations. So I'm coming from the perspective of that intersection of where public policy decisions impact lives and kind of a foot in both worlds. So I thought what I would do with my time today
is to tell you a little bit about what's happened in Ohio in the last year as a way to illustrate some of the policies and the terms you've seen in this report, and to maybe bring it down to one more level. Just very briefly, we're a large state, as folks know. We very much mirror the themes that are found in the report, so I won't go into detail on that. But the big story, and I think why I'm here, is that in 2010, Ohio had a fast track on implementing some simplification measures. And I wanted to give you a little more background on how that came to be, because I think it's very helpful to illustrate this. As the report states, our now former Governor Strickland was the first governor to accept Secretary Sebelius' challenge of connecting kids to coverage. And he did this back in March, on March 10th, as part of our Covering Kids and Families Conference. And he committed at that time to making sure that all of Ohio's uninsured eligible kids would get enrolled within the next 5 years. We think we don't have to wait that long. And as a way of doing that, he also committed to some simplification policies, including presumptive eligibility for children and pregnant women, 12-month continuous coverage for children, and express lane eligibility. And exactly 3 weeks later, on April 1st, Ohio had implemented presumptive eligibility for children and also 12-month continuous eligibility. That's a big deal. And I really have to give credit to our technical assistance team of Tricia Brooks and Donna Cohen Ross, who looked our state officials in the eyes and, frankly, the advocates, and said, "You can do this." And indeed, that was true. And CMS was a great partner in helping us navigate that. But so the big lesson, obviously, the 30,000-foot lesson, is government can work fast and efficiently when it has to and when it chooses to. Beyond that, there are a couple of lessons I wanted to share. Leadership counts. I mean, we have been making steady progress on various simplification bits and pieces over the last few years in our state, offering telephone renewals, doing 12-month renewal for parents, things like that. There was a lot of interest and support among administration and legislative officials to keep going farther, but it wasn't until the governor said, "We will do this," that we actually were able to take those steps. Backing up, laying the groundwork makes such a difference. Joan kind of alluded to some issues. We are also a county-based eligibility system with 88 counties in Ohio and almost 12 million people. So these changes are much more than policy and operational changes. They are at their core cultural changes in the way that we approach public programs. That's a piece of work. On the other hand, we have, through the advocacy community, worked very hard over the past several years to lay the groundwork for these reforms. I can literally say that everyone, from Governor Strickland himself to cabinet directors to legislative leaders to our partners in the county eligibility agencies, know what churning is. They know that 2/3 of Ohio's uninsured kids could right now be covered on Medicaid, and so we have to focus on making our current program stronger. And they know what are some policy options and tools that are available to help us, address this problem. So the governor's public announcement and commitment didn't come out of the blue. It was part of a narrative that had been constructed over the years and developed and supported by data and what other states are doing. And I think that was evident by the bipartisan support that it enjoyed. These were administrative decisions. The governor did not need the legislature to approve this. But by April, we also all knew that our state was facing a pretty stiff budget deficit. And on the one hand, when you look at these policies, cost more money, get more kids into Medicaid, keep them covered longer. Why are you growing a budget in a deficit period? On the other hand, it brings efficiencies to the program. It does what we said we're going to do. What we've committed to doing is to covering uninsured kids, especially the poorer kids, first. So when the little administrative part that needed to happen of going to the controlling board to approve these policies we had no problem. The issue of cost was not raised, and I think that was pretty remarkable to, you know, at that point in time. And then the third lesson, Cindy, incentives work. our aggressive timeline was driven very much solely by the possibility of securing the CHIPRA performance bonus dollars. We had to hit an April 1st deadline in order to qualify, and then that's exactly what happened, and Ohio was one of the 15 states who was recently awarded the performance bonus at the end of December. So we're very proud of that. We're working very hard to make sure at least some of those dollars are reinvested back into further simplification as well. I think the fact that those bonus dollars are available for the next several fiscal years hopefully will help us hold on to those measures. We are not protected by the MOE because we had an April 1st implementation. But, you know, we feel good that there's an argument to be made for continuing regardless. So I just wanted to spend a couple of my last minutes talking more broadly about why these policies matter. I think that, you know, clearly the simplest message is that Medicaid and CHIP work. We mirror the country in terms of we've been able to hold steady and see improvement in our child uninsured rate only because we have an effective Medicaid and CHIP program. And coverage alone isn't the picture. We know that, but coverage also matters. Children who are enrolled in Medicaid and CHIP are more likely to have well child visits, to have their vaccinations, more consistent medical treatment. They also have fewer hospitalizations and emergency room visits than uninsured children. So the data is very clear on that. And I think an evolving understanding is how stability of coverage also matters. So we've been able to really build some nice partnerships with the provider community who very much see, you know, what we have at stake is real different to try to provide consistent care to a child whose tenure on Medicaid might be 7 months compared to a child who can maintain that coverage for several years. So, you know, that's why a policy like 12-month continuous eligibility matters. It also means from a family perspective, a working mom who is in line for a modest raise or maybe picking up more hours at her job, you know, may have to make a decision whether or not that would put her child's coverage in jeopardy. With 12-month continuous, at least for that year, that's not a question. And in Ohio, most of our kids on Medicaid are now clustering at the lower income eligibility level. But I have talked to moms who are on near that cusp of 200% and are faced with that decision. And at least now they can have some peace of mind that that won't happen during that year. And also the cutting red tape helps our eligibility agencies, our county agencies, better manage growing caseloads. Our county JFS agencies are very frankly overwhelmed. Over the last 4 years, they've had a 40% cut in their funding. At the same time, many of the programs that they administer have seen a demand of larger than 50%. Statewide, our 88 counties have 3,250 fewer staff than just 3 years ago. So clearly, streamlining and modernization are absolutely vital for our eligibility system. When counties could start offering telephone renewal, they report less crowded waiting rooms, less amount of time it takes a caseworker to process a case. And I think looking forward, of great interest for both the agencies and advocates is exactly what Trish and Samantha were talking about, a better use of data matching to verify information up front, rather than asking families to produce paper. We're one of those antiquated, outdated eligibility systems. It will be a stretch, but I think there's absolutely a sense that that is a next step we have to take. So in closing, I guess only last thing I would say is that at the end of the day, the very simple truth is it is about kids. And over, the public has demonstrated strong support for kids' health. And behind the statistics are real people. I just wanted to share three vignettes. A colleague recently talked to a dad in Cincinnati who has three kids. He's currently unemployed. He gets $1,290 per month in unemployment compensation, and he's been paying $960 per month for COBRA coverage. He had no idea that he and his kids qualified for Medicaid. But thanks to a local outreach program, he now knows and he's getting help to apply. I talked to a couple last year who are longtime small business owners, but their revenues had gone down and they could no longer afford to pay for health coverage out of pocket. But they still had a son in junior high school who likes to play sports. So the mom found us online, picked up the phone, and literally said, I never thought I'd ask this, but how do I get my son on Medicaid? And then finally, our friend Emily, who some folks here have met, she's a six-year-old girl with Down syndrome. She was uninsured for almost 2 years because her self-employed father made too much for Medicaid, and she couldn't get affordable health insurance because of her pre-existing condition. Her family situation changed, and she now is on Medicaid, and she's getting the services she needs. And her parents have peace of mind at last, if not for themselves, at least for their daughter. So the, you know, all of these efforts that we do to make this program accessible, to make it effective, really, really matters.
Thank you. And now we'll turn to some questions from the audience. If you would please raise your hand so a mic can find you and then identify yourself before you pose your question. Thank you.
Do you want me to stand up? Or just, hi, my name is Catherine Finley. I work with some Medicaid providers. And Cindy, this is for you. I don't know how much you can say, but I'm just curious. We've heard a lot about the Colorado hospital provider tax. And as you know, there's an important provider tax that's kind of floating around CMS and OPM or OMB in relation to MCO provider tax. And I'm just curious. Do you want me to stand up? Oh, I'm just curious if I saw in the HHS's blueprint for the 2011 regs that there's a placeholder for the provider tax on MCOs. And I'm curious when that might come out, if there's anything you can share with us about that. Clearly, given the economic situation, there's a lot of states that are concerned about it.
It's a fee, not a tax.
Oh.
Very important distinction.
Learned a lot being in Washington. I think you're referring to there's regulation that we had been planning or that we are planning or working on that relates to the changes in that were established in 2007, really, around states' ability to only tax Medicaid MCOs, managed care organizations. The idea of a provider tax is that they're fine, and many states, as Colorado's story illustrates, are using them as a way to finance the non-federal share. What they can't do is just be a way to recycle dollars from the federal government without any real state contribution, even if it's not general fund contribution, but real dollars there. So we were looking at some provisions relating to the implementation of the 2007 law. So it's I can't tell you exactly when that might come out. It's still under consideration. I just would add that many states, though, are Colorado, California, many states are moving forward with provider taxes, and we're working closely with states to design them in ways that work under the federal law.
Okay, next question.
Hi, Jennifer Lubell, Health Reform Week. Does Kaiser have any updated figures on how many uninsured low-income adults under the health reform law are going to be covered in 2014 versus how many are being covered now?
That would be you, Samantha.
I'm not aware. We don't have any breakouts that specifically look at the adults without dependent children in terms of actual numbers, either projected under health reform or currently. I think that break them out as a separate group. I think we do have some estimates that look at adults overall, but I don't think it breaks it down to that specific level of the adults without dependent children.
You know, this might be something we should talk with you guys about, because states in their exchange planning grants are doing a lot of modeling to look at that population, because many of us have done household surveys and other kinds of surveys where we have some pretty decent numbers about which program people are going to go into, whether it'll be a Medicaid eligible person or somebody in the exchange. But we're kind of digging deeper into those data, and it may be something we could work with you all about to collect, at least from the states that have already started doing their modeling.
But we do know that the bulk of the adults under 133% of poverty who are uninsured are adults without dependent children, and that they will be one of the major groups being brought in. And there'll be a challenge, obviously, for some of these enrollment procedures that we've talked about today that are used to picking up the parents of children and or the children, and this is a group that has been outside of the Medicaid system, so may require some very different enrollment and outreach efforts than the ones we're talking about today for the populations already covered.
Can I second that? Because in our modeling, this is a very diverse population in a state like Colorado. I mean, you have everything from fairly healthy people who live in ski towns and don't make very much money and live somewhat poorly by my standards because they choose to live in a ski town and spend their discretionary income on ski passes and Starbucks. And versus adults without dependent children with severe mental illness who are homeless and waiting for their, you know, their disability designation. So this is a very large, diverse population, and we don't pretend for a minute to know exactly all of the different techniques and approaches we're going to have to take to ensure that we find the people, that we convince them that it's okay to enroll in a government program. I mean, this is something we think about a lot, and I think states are very cognizant of the upcoming challenges that we will all have to make sure that that population gets their health care benefits.
Okay. And the one thing I would just add on thinking about the enrollment, there's about 16 million people, at least what the Congressional Budget Office projects, will be gained coverage in Medicaid and CHIP as a result of the Affordable Care Act. Most of those people will gain coverage through Medicaid. Most of those people, as Diane suggests, will be the adults and adults without children, simply because, as the data show, there's very little coverage currently available for those individuals, so they make up a large segment of the uninsured population. We are, as you look at the kind of guidance that we've been putting out over the last couple of months, we, together with OSIO, very much think of the enrollment and the enrollment process as being on a continuum. So it's Medicaid, it's CHIP, it's the exchange, I think that will not only so it's very not going to be siloed. So we don't we need to do some very targeted outreach, I think, as Joan indicates, because different people are in different circumstances. But on the other hand, there's going to be very broad outreach generally to people who are uninsured, saying now there's coverage for you. And I think that will really change the way in which we have opportunities to bring people into the system, and then the system itself, being anticipated to be seamless and not siloed, will then contribute to the ability of people to get enrolled in the appropriate program at the appropriate time.
Next question.
I just want to take this time to say thank you. My name is Lucy Wilson-Keir from the Department of Healthcare Finance in the district. My question goes to Joanne. I want to say thank you for your presentation, your briefing. But I just want to know that what were some of your challenges in your what approach or strategy did you use in getting the beneficiaries involved in the system?
The beneficiaries. You know, we rely very, very heavily on community-based organizations. We, even in the good years when we were spending, you know, $2 million a year of general fund on marketing and outreach and advertising, that's a great, you know, broad brush stroke to have your governor doing cute little television ads with children. But really, the most effective interventions, we think, are really embedded in neighborhoods and communities where neighbors and trusted people and trusted organizations come together and make a commitment. It's why our enrollment has continued to go up, even though we've pulled back every penny of general fund on outreach. We don't spend any money on that. But by the time the economy got bad, the local foundations and national foundation work and community and faith-based organizations have really embraced this culture and believe, as we do, if the policy says you're eligible, we want you in the door and we want to provide services. So everything from – there's this really Aurora, Colorado is a suburb of Denver, one of the community-based organizations – is doing a special outreach effort with Asian restaurants. It's a community that has a lot of ethnic restaurants. And a lot of the families that work in the restaurants and their children are eligible for programs. So they came up with this very interesting targeted work to go into these restaurants and talk to the owners and educate them with so it's everything from that to, you know, enrollment fairs, you know, the traditional things where you go into a community. But I would say that's really key for us.
Trish.
I'm going to add to this from my experience as a CHIP director. The larger the percentage of uninsured, then broad-based strategies do work. So some of those ads and, you know, getting the word out that these programs exist are really important. As you chunk down the number of uninsured, your efforts have to become more targeted. You have to really understand who the uninsured population is. And I ditto Joan's comments about reaching into communities and using community partners who have trusted relationships with families, and that makes a huge difference. But we would be remiss not to point out that many of the, particularly children who are eligible have previously been enrolled. And for whatever reason, their families find it too hard to stay enrolled. They fall off the program, they have gaps in coverage, and then experience a medical need and find themselves coming back into these programs. So streamlining these processes are really important, particularly at renewal, but also at new enrollment. I mean, I've had families in New Hampshire make an attempt to apply on 3, 4, 5 occasions and just can't quite make it through the process because they are working 3 part-time jobs to piece a living together for their families, and coming up with that last bit of paperwork is just really hard to accomplish. So the streamlining procedures are really critical for us to cover all eligible children.
Okay. Next question.
Hi, my name is Mary Beth Hardy. I work at the George Washington University Department of Health Policy. And some of our funders are very excited about the opportunities that the Affordable Care Act brings in promoting preventative benefits under the United States Preventive Services Task Force A and B recommendations. And the Affordable Care Act creates some incentives for states to start offering those services. And so some of our funders are, you know, looking ahead to that and hoping to promote their services that they really care about, and hoping that states will start to pick up on some of these screening and testing and other preventative services. And so I was wondering if Joan or Mary, if perhaps you could speak about the likelihood that Ohio or Colorado or other states, what the likelihood might be that given these financial constraints that you all are facing, that you might add additional optional Medicaid benefits, and whether or not the incentives in health reform are enough that states might pick up on these services. And perhaps, Cindy, you could talk a bit about what the agency is planning to do to, you know, to get states to pick up on that section of the act and to start offering those important and needed services.
I'll just turn this on. I'll just say very briefly that it's really hard to speculate with a change in leadership and administration now. And Ohio has done a lot of really good planning and really good work to date. It's a little unclear where that will go, but I will say, talking with previous Department of Insurance officials just several months ago about that issue, I mean, they acknowledged it would be a very heavy lift, you know, for a state like Ohio to consider doing that. I don't anticipate that would change given our new environment, but that's speculation. So,
yeah, I think that's true for us too, although we do offer quite already some of the things that are being discussed. And as we're thinking about our benefit design for our Adults Without Dependent Children program, even prior to 2014, we certainly are looking at primary prevention, early intervention as a way to make sure that the benefits package is what people need it to be. But it really raises, I want to circle back to something Cindy said, because it's really, and something Mary said as well, if this is really about public insurance being the health insurance plan, the ongoing health insurance plan for children in low-income families, then we need to think about it that way. And what we have to do in the back room to sort out the financing is very different than this continuum of services that we want people to get. And if we want children to get in the door and stay in the door for not just a year, but probably longer than that, then we have to think about it the way we think about being in a commercial plan for several years, where the plan and the providers actually have an opportunity to do something to help us get healthier. We don't want people in and out the door. And if we don't think about the policy that way, I think you have to think about the policy that way if you want to change the service delivery system, which is where all the waste is going on. So you have to marry up those two things, and certainly an emphasis on screening and prevention and early intervention is going to be critical if we really want to save dollars in the system.
Yeah, I'll just quickly echo that. That was exactly going to be my point. I think there's a tremendous amount of energy going on right now, and we're going to be doing a lot of work with states over the next period of time on really promoting greater, better models of integrated care delivery systems. And so I think the energy and the interest is not just should we do preventive care, should we do substance abuse, should we do this benefit, should we do that benefit, but how do we put together a service delivery system that really meets the needs of individuals, because I think then not only are we going to better serve individuals, but then we can get a handle on getting best value for the dollar spent. So I think there'll be a lot of interest in that, particularly in the context of integrated care delivery systems. You know, and I would mention, although it doesn't certainly take care of all issues, that for the newly eligible individuals coming into the Medicaid program starting in 2014, for 3 years, the match will be 100% financed by the federal government. That'll make it easier. And as you say, there's easier for states to think about their benefit packages. And then there's a bump up in the match rate for states not getting the 100% for certain populations if they pick up the preventive care. So there is a financial boost, but I really think the energy will go in the context of thinking about how to do good integrated systems of care for people.
Thank you. I have a follow-up on the presentation by Ms. Artiga. May I please ask if you could, in a question about figure 15, the map of coverage of childless adults by, could you go over the seven states or six states in D.C. that now provide Medicaid comparable coverage to childless adults? And is that somehow, is that information in the table four?
Table four.
It's a mix of states that have taken up the new option under health reform to expand early to adults. So there you have Connecticut and D.C. There are also some waiver states. Actually, the rest of them are really waiver states that have longer-standing coverage programs for those adults and have chosen to provide really the full Medicaid benefit package through those programs. And if you look on tables 4 and 5, it'll break out both the authority through which the coverage is provided, so you can see whether it's a waiver or state-funded program for those adults, as well as the scope of benefits. So you can see there those states that are providing the full benefit coverage. And I would just also note that some of those states also have other programs that provide more limited coverage up to higher incomes than they provide the full Medicaid coverage for those adults. So if you look at, for instance, Connecticut, they have the option to cover adults through Medicaid, but they also have a state-funded premium subsidy, subsidized coverage program for adults up to 300% of poverty that offers more limited benefits. Hawaii provides full coverage up to 100% for which enrollment is currently closed, but they have more limited waiver coverage that goes up to 200%, and also some coverage options that are not shown in the table for previously covered people up to 300% of poverty. And if you look at Vermont, their VHAP program is their Medicaid benefit waiver program serving those adults, and then they also have Catamount Care, which is a more limited program that goes up to 300% of poverty. Oh, you want the ones that the total seven? So the total seven are Arizona, Connecticut, Delaware, D.C., Hawaii, New York, and Vermont, and they're also labeled out in the full report.
Hi. Excuse me. Alice Weiss from Nashby and Maximizing Enrollment. I want to thank you for the expanded data in the report. It's very rich, and I'm looking forward to digging in. I had a couple of questions because you had some new questions on the extent to which states are using the same system for multiple programs, both other social service human service programs and Medicaid and CHIP. And then you had some other data on the extent to which states are using data that they may have from other programs and not asking for documentation. And so that led me to some additional questions about whether or not you were able to dig deeper, and I know you asked a lot of questions, but whether you're able to dig any deeper on the extent to which there's sort of more of a seamless approach, an integrated approach between Medicaid and CHIP for the 34 states that use the same system for eligibility for Medicaid and CHIP, and also the extent to which in those eight states that are using data and not asking for additional documentation at application, what do we know about which programs they're sharing data with, and what can that tell us about lessons for the future when we have to do more paper-free applications?
Yes, Alice, I'm sure you want to get your hands on all of that data. We have some follow-up work to do. I think trying to tie some of these pieces together and do, you know, multiple layered queries to say how many states do this, also do this, and also do that, and crunching these tables as they are over the holidays was challenging enough. But we're definitely going to do some follow-up work in that regard. I think what's really striking when we look at the states that have the capability to use systems to do administrative data matches, it is still astonishing to me that they haven't stopped asking for paperwork. Now, we understand that all states reserve the right that if the data that they have access to doesn't give them the information they need to make an accurate decision about someone's eligibility, they should ask for paper or more paper. And some of these private wage databases only report earnings from, say, very large employers and don't give you earnings, for example, for the self-employed. But it's interesting to look at the lag. And I know in some work I've done in Louisiana recently, and we were talking about what happens when you finish the electronic application and you're ready to hit that button that says submit, and it comes back and says, we need from you the following documents. And yet Louisiana is one of the most progressive states in terms of using those verifications. So it's funny the lag that you see there, and then you see that lag as it trickles out to parents. But there's certainly more work to do. And I think it's really, you know, states go, oh, gosh, we didn't go back and look at that application and realize that we didn't need to ask, you know, for that paperwork. So it's a sort of a long and mixed answer to say we've got more digging in to do. In terms of the kinds of databases people are using, though, I will say we tested the survey instrument after making some changes on a few states, and it really started to get complex in a lot of areas, and we had to make some decisions about how much data we were going to collect and whether we could actually keep state officials on the phone for 4 hours in asking every possible question that we were really interested in. And that's one of the things that sort of went by the wayside, is getting a full list of what those databases are.
Yeah. Can I just point out, too, it would be very naive for people to think that just building one big special black box computer program to determine eligibility for every program was the answer, because it's not. You have to think about the application itself, the software, in conjunction with the business process that is used to get people's data into that system. And if you try and fix just the what's in the black box without adjusting the business process around it, who collects what, who submits what do you ask people for, how do you get rid of all of the paper shuffling in 64 or 88 counties, then you can have the most special black box in the world, and it won't solve the problems if you don't address the business process at the same time.
And if I could, I mean, one of the issues that I've had to learn, because sometimes we get Medicaid myopia and just look at folks as, you know, health needing health care. But we've seen a real migration of our caseload in Ohio, where in the past we had seen, and I don't remember the exact percentages, but a fair amount of kids having Medicaid only. Now that's reversed. So the majority of kids in our state have Medicaid plus, whether it's cash or food stamps. And so, and that's a shared eligibility system in our state, which is probably common in other states. So it may be tempting and, in one hand, easy to think about, let's go in and simplify Medicaid, but this is a system attached to other systems. And these are consumers who have often needs across the, you know, the spectrum. So I think balancing, continuing to move forward on Medicaid and preparing for 2014 and doing that across the spectrum, you know, is a real opportunity, but huge challenge at the state level as well.
Sue Ellen Galbraith with Anchor, and it's not even a question, it's my plea to Diane, and thanks to Diane and all of Kaiser. Since federal officials can't lobby, but they are in ear sound of points, many of us, my name is Sue Ellen Galbraith with Anchor, and we're private providers of supports to people with disabilities. And we're very challenged to get the information, accurate information, to the states, to advocates, to state legislators, to governors. As you may know, there are some state officials in a new political climate that aren't as thrilled about Medicaid as many of us are. And it's a data-driven world, but we're dependent upon the data that is being driven by the political wishes at the state level. So it is extremely important for Kaiser to keep getting this information out, and what other states are doing for cost efficiencies as we balance the need for the Band-Aids right now for budget crisis against the balancing with systems, real constructive systems change, and the opportunities it can bring to Medicaid.
Well, and I'd also say that this look is at eligibility and enrollment that affects children, childless adults, and parents. But as you know, we also try and look at what's happening with home and community-based services with some of the other aspects of the program. So we hear you. And we have a question here.
Hi, Doug Trapp, American Medical News. This is probably more for Mary and Joan. But with all the enrollment focus, are you also looking at whether or not these enrollees are getting care, like tracking their access to care?
Yes, we are, mostly for our kids, easier for kids, because we have this major initiative around medical homes, so we track children's enrollment. Plus, most of our kids, more of our children than our adults are in managed care plans. We just have better access to information about them. But through quality assurance reports, through the EPSDT reporting is probably one of the best ways that we use HEDIS measures, CAHPS, all the usual surveys that states, I think just about everybody is using in their Medicaid programs to determine, you know, whether people are using the service. You know, Trish, I think it was Tricia who mentioned, or maybe Mary, you know, you still do have this churn problem. One of the problems we've had with presumptive eligibility is that families enroll when their kids are sick or have an emergency, and then they don't follow through on the full application, and so they're going on and off. They're using care, using the financing mechanism when they need the care. So this is about, you know, getting coverage, getting the policy right, getting people in the door. But there's a big responsibility around educating families about being better consumers and how to use the healthcare system in a way that would really advantage them and their kids too. So we have some work to do in that area.
I would say we're very similar in that. We also have our child population in managed care, so that is the primary service delivery system and the way that those issues are monitored. We do have, I think, some specific projects that the state has undertaken, for instance, with the managed care plans themselves to put an effort to getting more of the developmental screenings, make sure that more children have those on schedule, and we have some quality projects in place that are also working in discrete areas. But I think it's a huge question, and, you know, we all want accountability, and we all want, you know, to see that very clear path that coverage results in better health outcomes for kids. And I think, you know, with the leadership, I'm thinking, Cindy, of the quality measures that were included in CHIPRA and some of that being put into place as well moving forward, that it'll give states better tools to answer some of those questions.
Thank you. Well, I think we've demonstrated today that there is a lot of variation in what's going on at the state level, but that coverage matters, but that in getting that coverage, the systems you put in place and the ways in which beneficiaries will interact with those systems are critical to translate eligibility levels into actual enrollment and coverage. We've heard also that incentives matter, stability matters, and one of the stable things is that we have done this survey for 10 years and we'll continue to do it, and we look forward to seeing next year all of you back here to hear what's changed and what's improved over the last year. And so thank you for being here today, and thank you to our report preparers and presenters, as well as to all of our panelists. Thank you very much.